Chapter 7. In an early January 1956 article describing Dorothy Kilgallen, a New York Post Daily Magazine reporter wrote, "She is an attractive woman with a delicate, moon-pale complexion, dark brunette hair, a knockout hourglass figure, and no inconsiderable bust line. She is a scrupulously coiffed model of respectable high-fashion style. Her deportment and appearance bespoke of 400's traditional veil and white sensibility, with an added twist of enviably tasteful up-to-date chic. She exudes class, grace, and noble distinction. Dorothy is, viewed from the proper angle, quite a dish." He added the ultimate compliment, calling her the most powerful female voice in America. Yet another article at the time provided a different window into Kilgallen's world. It described her as a woman of alabaster complexion, china blue eyes, and extreme feminine sensibilities who dresses with stylish perfection, often wears snow-white kid gloves and picturesque hats that neither smokes nor swears, drinks in moderation, and attends Mass unfailingly each Sunday. She is romantic and sentimental. She weeps and blushes easily, has a schoolgirl's helpless giggle, and a little girl's handwriting. She is warm and kind to her relatives, loyal and generous to her friends, loving to her children. Such plaudits, to Kilgallen's delight, prompted revered television host Edward R. Murrow to schedule a live interview with her and her family for his highly popular CBS program Person to Person. This occurred 1 year after, as noted, he interviewed Marilyn Monroe. It took place in what the New York Post described as a 16-room house on the fashionable east side of Manhattan, with interiors of pink, mauve, and lavender, amid ceramic cherubs, china cupids, and fragile Victorian antiques. The interview aired January 20, 1956. Murrow gave a lengthy introduction of the Kilgallen family in his distinctive voice, as puffs of smoke filtered into the air from the trademark cigarette he held between the fingers of his left hand. He said, "Dorothy and Dick, Mr. and Mrs. Richard Colmer, have been broadcasting a radio program here in New York City for about 10 years. But both are well known beyond the boundaries of this city. Dorothy is Dorothy Kilgallen, veteran reporter, Broadway columnist for Hearst and other newspapers, a magazine author, a veteran inquisitor on What's My Line, and the mother of three." Highlights of the program, aired in black and white and available at thedorothykilgallenstory.org, included showing the audience the Gone with the Wind-themed drawing room. It featured pale lavender walls and white bridal satin curtains. A large portrait of Dorothy hung above the fireplace. The Victorian-themed dining room and the black room one floor up were showcased. The latter featured walls and ceiling in black, framed with white draperies, and a large Kelly green rug providing contrast. The Americana room was a true conversation piece. It featured Civil War relics, including a Battle of Princeton painting, a Lady Cigar Store Indian, a lavish collection of eagles, 17 in all, a lamp, and a drum table. There was also a collection of antique penny piggy banks, a trick dog, Punch and Judy, and a clown. They were on the mantel above another fireplace. Jill, age 12, and Carrie, 22 months, made brief appearances. In one highlight of the interview, Murrow asked Kilgallen, "If you had to be confined to one job of the many you do, which would it be?" After taking a couple of seconds to consider her choice, she said, "Well, Ed, I love television. I have so much fun playing the What's My Line game, and I love our morning radio program, too. But I think I would have to settle for my first love, my true love, the newspaper business. It still has me and always will, I hope." This statement of dedication to her profession is somewhat indicative of what Marilyn Monroe told a reporter in 1955. "The thing I'd like most is to become a real actress." Kilgallen's five-story townhouse also featured an Otis elevator and front and rear staircases. A large powder room and a small mail room adjoined a reception area on the ground floor. The bottom flight of the main stairwell opened nearby. Gazing straight up permitted the view of a rooftop skylight. During the Christmas season, giant snowballs, giant snowflakes, and colorful ornaments hung from the top over the staircase. In the room featuring furniture from the Gone with the Wind set, French doors, chandeliers, and expensive art completed the decor. There was only one electric light in the room, with candles spread throughout. Kilgallen's parties were legendary as the couple became society's darlings. Entertainer Steve Allen said, "Everybody who was anybody was at Dorothy's parties." Guests included George Harrison of Beatles fame, and actresses such as Gina Lollobrigida and Jane Mansfield, who appeared in 27 films, including The Girl Can't Help It and Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, before she died in a car crash in Louisiana in 1967. Regarding Mansfield, Kilgallen had written about her in her Voice of Broadway column when 20th Century Fox objected to the bombshell actress's thirst for publicity, but it was the studio's own fault since, as noted in a June 2017 Hollywood Reporter story by Eric Lieberman, the PR department had borrowed the test-driven public persona of Marilyn Monroe, by promoting her as a sexpot first and an actress second. In fact, the campaign was so successful that in 1957, the year after her film The Girl Can't Help It was released, Mansfield beat Marilyn in popularity polls, causing one of Kilgallen's rivals, Luella Parsons, to write that Mansfield's name was magic at the box office. Regarding Fox's complaint that Jane would open a cracker box if she thought she could get the press there, the studio quip added, "She has been far too accessible to every lensman, scribe, and high school reporter." Regarding the gatherings at Kilgallen's home, her butler's daughter, Brenda Desjardins, who lived in the townhouse along with her parents, told this author, "They had great parties, like out of movies, decorated the house, food in and out. Dorothy had golden dinner plates, crystal for them, lots of live music. Louis Armstrong was there, Jane Mansfield in the kitchen where Mom was cooking, also Joan Crawford and Betty Davis, best known for her line, 'Fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy night,' in the 1950 film All About Eve, were there. One time Mansfield started taking off her clothes and my dad kept helping her put them back on." Desjardins added, "Dad once helped Marilyn Monroe get to her car because she was intoxicated. I also remember a party for daughter Jill where Dorothy asked me to teach her how to do the twist." Desjardins' account appears to cement the friendship Marilyn and Dorothy enjoyed, since obviously the latter would have had to approve an invitation for the former so that Marilyn could join the party. Desjardins also said that Johnny Mathis was at Kilgallen's home as well. He appeared on one What's My Line program where Kilgallen guessed his identity based on his having autographed a pair of her shoes for her collection while at the party. Recalling more of the parties, Desjardins said, "Sammy Davis Jr. came to a party. My father went to the door and this black man was there and my dad thought he was a delivery person. Davis was mad and told Mom, but she just laughed." Of Kilgallen's influence, American cabaret singer and pianist Bobby Short told a reporter, "She was tremendously powerful. People would kill to be in her column." To celebrate husband Richard's 46th birthday, Kilgallen had chosen New York City's Plaza Hotel as the site for the party. She surprised guests by accepting an invitation to dance with Short, the African-American cabaret singer and pianist best known for his interpretations of songs by popular composers of the first half of the 20th century. They included Rodgers and Hart. That duo collaborated on 28 Broadway musicals and more than 500 songs during their careers. Onlookers who objected to any interaction between the races were thunderstruck by Kilgallen's audacity. She did not care. Bobby Short was a friend. It didn't matter if he were black, white, or blue. According to Short, Kilgallen made him a star. "I was astonished. Here I was, playing a club in Paris, and friends kept sending me clippings from Dorothy's column, raving about me in absentia. When I left Paris to return to New York, everything was easier because people who had never heard of my work knew my name. Dorothy Kilgallen was responsible for the beginning of a whole new career for me. Interestingly, Marilyn Monroe also helped boost the careers of several budding performers, including Ella Fitzgerald. During the 1950s, Ella was not allowed to play at Mocambo, Hollywood's most popular nightclub, since she was African-American. Marilyn, who was a big fan of Fitzgerald's, called the owner and said that if he booked Ella, Marilyn would be there every night, which guaranteed huge press coverage. He booked Fitzgerald, and Marilyn was there, front table, every night. Ella praised Marilyn, stating, "After that, I never had to play a small jazz club again. She was an unusual woman, a little ahead of her time, and she didn't know it." Meanwhile, as husband Richard Colmer had strayed from the marriage by cultivating a string of Broadway star actress wannabes, among other vices, Kilgallen's love affair blossomed with sandy-haired singer Johnny Ray, 14 years her junior. Fellow columnist Liz Smith called the affair peculiar, while adding, "Here was this white-gloved Catholic making out with a homosexual all over town." Most times the love affair took place at Ray's apartment. Kilgallen, who had added a pair of shoes autographed by Ray to her vast collection, called An Affair to Remember, starring Deborah Carr and Cary Grant, the film she and Ray had watched together when they first met, a winner. In her column, she wrote that the movie was a tribute to those who were getting tired of pictures about dope addicts, alcoholics, unattractive butchers, and men who sleep in their underwear. In contrast to the hard-edged persona Kilgallen was infamous for, Ray said of her, "She was probably the most feminine woman I've ever known, and I always thought she was a pretty lady, the softest thing you ever touched. All those people that made fun of her, that was just plain sick." Friend Hank Wessinger said of the couple, "Kilgallen and Ray were like two little kids. They would go romping off and do their little silly things. Together, they were like two children. They were in love." Kilgallen truly loved Ray and at times showed strong possessiveness and jealousy. In a New York Post article published in 1960, a friend of hers was quoted as saying, "I saw her at the Waldorf one night with Johnny Ray. She left the table for a moment, and some young pretty girl usurped her chair and proceeded to tell Ray how good a singer she thought he was. Dorothy came back, flew at the girl, telling her, 'Keep your hands off my escort and leave the table.' It was the only time I ever saw her lose her temper in public." At one point, Kilgallen's bookkeeper was astonished to keep receiving invoices from a company called Cary Cadillac for more than $500. It turned out that the car service charged for waiting at Ray's apartment while Kilgallen made love with her true love. Friends and other onlookers had watched with astonishment when Ray took off Kilgallen's shoe and kissed her foot during a romantic evening at the El Morocco. Marilyn also frequented that NYC hotspot, once having made headlines for dancing with Truman Capote circa 1955. Alan Eichler, who managed Ray during the latter years of his life, said it was a genuine love affair, sexual in nature. Johnny said he actually gave Dorothy her first orgasm. Tad Mann, Ray's personal manager for nearly 40 years, said, "Dorothy and Johnny likened themselves to American royalty. He was her Prince Charming." William Randolph Hearst Jr. recalled, "One day in 1962, Dorothy marched into the Journal-American City Room draped in a mink coat with Johnny Ray on her arm. She also was towing a couple of fancy dogs. Dorothy turned every head. She was a star, and when we needed an exclusive interview with astronaut John Glenn after he circled the Earth, she manipulated herself into a group of Marines who were protecting him. Next morning, Dorothy's headline read, 'What makes John Glenn tick?'" Over time, the relationship cooled, but Kilgallen loved Johnny Ray and continued to mother him from afar. a fancy Christmas tree trimming extravaganza and New Year's Eve costume ball were part of the winter season fun at Kilgallen's home. Separate rooms became decorated nightclubs. When guests dressed as movie stars and other celebrities entered these rooms, they gasped. Judy Garland, she toured with Johnny Ray in Europe in 1969, and Ray was the best man at her wedding to her last husband, the Count Basie Orchestra and other friends of the Colmers performed. One year, Dorothy dressed as Scarlett O'Hara and Richard as Rhett Butler. At these parties, Kilgallen was the champion at word games and charades. She always played to win. In fact, in one of the New York Post articles about her, Kilgallen's friend Faye Emerson, famous as a film and stage actress in the 1940s, before transitioning to television in the 1950s and hosting her own talk show, said Kilgallen used to play charades until 3 or 4 in the morning, and nobody was better at it. The Post added, "Then, as now, she and her husband Dick Colmer were noted for their game parties, at which the chief entertainment was a round of charades or 20 questions of Botticelli, like 20 questions, except the person should be at least as famous as the Italian Renaissance artist Sandro Botticelli." Kilgallen also liked the alphabet game, where the players had to come up with the names of prominent people whose initials matched letters of the alphabet arranged in parallel columns on a sheet of paper. Kilgallen's close friend, press agent Gene Bock, later to become an Academy Award-nominated documentary filmmaker, told the Post that Kilgallen's New Year's Eve parties were the party in NYC. She added, "When they stopped giving them, everybody gave up on New Year's Eve." At some of the parties, Kilgallen sang. In a funny staged photo from the time, she serenades daughter Jill and son Dickie, who doesn't seem too enthused with her performance. Friend Bill Harbach provided a glimpse into Kilgallen's persona during her daily personal and business life. The Post quoted him as saying, "She walks with great erectness, shoulders back and straight, and when she comes into a room, she glides in rather than walks in. But she uses her hands a great deal when she talks and turns her head rapidly to face anyone who is facing her." Jean Bock added, "When she talks, she is very careful with her choice of words. She never slurs any word. She never says, yeah." Harbach provided another insight, somewhat disturbing to him, into Kilgallen's persona. He told the Post, "I always find it difficult to realize that the Dorothy I know who is sweet and warm is also Dorothy the columnist. I never discuss her columns with her, but I know she picks on the most damaging and vulnerable areas she can find in someone she wants to go after." While close friends like Gene Bock and Bill Harbach were certainly admirers of Kilgallen, even while having some trepidation about her lethal columns, fellow members of the media, the other reporters, and especially some press agents questioned her integrity at times. Many felt she was what they called a sucker for an unsubstantiated story about a personality and thus didn't do her homework to confirm the allegation before printing it in Voice of Broadway. Press agents were always pestering her to include an item about their clients since being in the column was publicity gold. While most of them spoke highly of her ethics, others criticized. For instance, the Post reported her great weakness for temperature items, anyone who was sick or dying, since Kilgallen sometimes threw those into a column without confirming the illness or death. One disturbing incident of Kilgallen not making sure the information provided to her was truthful or even possible had occurred in December 1948. A press agent attempted to trick her by sending a story about an actress in peril attempting to get her daughter out of Hungary. Kilgallen posted the story, only to learn that the actress had actually died nearly 20 years earlier. Apparently, this episode led to Kilgallen being much more careful in the following years, including having her secretary check the veracity of any tips before the account was included in her column. At one point, Myrtle Verne served as Kilgallen's secretary. On May 5, 1960, just months before Marilyn died, Myrtle appeared on the television program To Tell the Truth as one of the three who was not who she said she was. Kilgallen's rare tendency to be less than factual regarding celebrity news did not affect her reporting of current events. In the Post article, the reporters had checked stories that involved exclusives, such as Spain being admitted to NATO as a result of President Eisenhower's upcoming visit with Franco, 1959, and anti-American factions in Panama are planning to blow up the Panama Canal, also 1959, and found them to be very legitimate, while being amazed at the credible sources she had and her interest in such matters. In 1959, Kilgallen hit hard at a controversial story written about the daughter of former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, calling it ironical, depressing to contemplate, but true, since Sarah Churchill's unfortunate arrests for drunkenness, she's become a desirable literary figure to New York publishers who are ready to offer her gigantic advances if she'll promise to write a tell-all autobiography. Without question, Kilgallen's sources stretched across the Atlantic Ocean and around the world. When Kilgallen's integrity was critiqued, she fought back, at one point telling Variety, "Ever since I was a little bitty girl around the newspaper, I have been allowed to use my typewriter and my own head, and any opinions expressed have been entirely mine. When I have to get permission to write about something that interests me, then I will exit quietly from the field of journalism." Jim Kilgallen was certainly proud of his daughter's accomplishments, writing, "Dorothy had an unerring instinct for news, a brilliant style of writing. She was accurate and had a flair for the apt phrase. She had an uncanny ability to produce scoops and an inordinate speed in turning out copy." In early 1959, just 5 years before she had her fateful interviews with Jack Ruby and 6 years before she died, Kilgallen had entered the world of international politics. Once again displaying her refusal to back away from controversial issues despite the danger, she flew to Miami and interviewed Cuban exiles, many of whom were armed. Some critics dispute whether she actually was in Miami, but there is little doubt about the interviews having taken place. Her friend, talk show host Larry King, told this author Kilgallen was gutsy, and her jumping into the highly explosive Cuban situation was a perfect example. Undaunted, Kilgallen wrote exclusively about the exiles' hatred for the Cuban dictator, despite the risk of harm, with her story amplified by her having visited Cuba before Castro's intended takeover, according to one segment of a What's My Line video clip. The proof of her visit was supplied by a contestant whose line of work was operating the roulette wheel in a Havana casino. Kilgallen laughed when he said she had lost $25 during her turn at the wheel, and then again when the Cuban man revealed they had both been on a return flight from Havana to Miami. In July of that same year, Kilgallen stunned millions of readers with what she called a Kilgallen exclusive, based on inside information from a confidential source, a mole. Becoming the first reporter to allege that the CIA and organized crime were teaming up to eliminate Fidel Castro, she wrote, in part, "U.S. intelligence is virtually non-existent if the government isn't aware that Russia already has bases in Cuba and Russian pilots in uniform are strutting openly in Havana. Fidel Castro is the target for so many assassins they're apt to fall over each other in their efforts to get him." Kilgallen added, "The mafia want to knock him off. So do the Batista sympathizers, of course, and then there are his own disillusioned rebels, just for starters. He has machine guns and other ammunition mounted on every key rooftop near his base of operations, but the smart money doubts if any amount of precaution can change his status as a clay pigeon." Meanwhile, in 1960, Kilgallen had tackled a juicy murder trial. It was in keeping with a quote she had given often, "When the big moment comes in a big story, you cannot beat a reporter away with clubs." One big moment in Kilgallen's career came when Los Angeles prosecutors charged Dr. Bernard Finch and his mistress, Carol Tregoff, with the murder of Finch's wife, Barbara Jean. Describing Tregoff, Kilgallen wrote that she was a pretty chic number, a brunette with a come-on smile, a figure that would make a preacher leave town. Regarding Finch, Kilgallen stated, "He's gray, getting a bit bald on top, but his profile is aristocratic, and his smile has great charm." A Hearst aide named Frank Conniff was quoted by the New York Post as proclaiming, "Kilgallen has been preparing for this big moment all along." Conniff then explained the big moment, writing, "Wearing eye-catching frocks to court every day and living off a six-figure Hearst expense account, she disarmed suspicious reporters with her friendliness, cashed checks for them, kept their press room supply of liquor replenished, taught them one of her games, played ladies' poker with them, and spread goodwill among court personnel." During the trial, Kilgallen used her celebrity status to many advantages. First, she secured an exclusive interview with Dr. Finch. In her Journal American article, she wrote, "The doctor does not look like putty. He looks more like leather-encased steel, but the legend of the siren who can make men strong is old and undying." She added, "The trial is more than a whodunit. It's a who'd believe it." Second, she ingratiated herself with a stage-struck court officer by setting up, through her sister Eleanor Kilgallen, a casting director, a screen test at MCA while, according to the New York Post, paying him admiring tributes in her column. Thus, it was no surprise to the other reporters, jealous of the scoop all of them were hoping for, that Kilgallen landed the privilege of interviewing the jurors after the case was concluded. After Dr. Finch and Carol Tregoff were convicted, Kilgallen, using inside information, headed her column with strong words. She wrote, "Dr. Bernie and Carol get what they deserved." Compliments for Kilgallen's coverage of the trial abounded. A reporter for Time magazine wrote, "In Los Angeles, busy Dorothy Kilgallen sometimes attracted more attention than the trial. She posed for pictures with the defendant, signed scores of autographs for admirers, and received an orchid from an unidentified California judge." Yet, for all that, her copy, rattled off on an electric typewriter in her hotel room, provided the best coverage of the Finch-Tregoff trial. It was also reported, "Kilgallen posed for pictures with the accused and had dinner at the home of both the prosecutor and the defense attorney." Summarizing Kilgallen's amazing performance at the Finch trial, the New York Post wrote, "It was one more journalistic triumph for Kilgallen. In her 30 years on the newspaper scene, there have been many like it. Marriages have foundered, murderers have gone to their reward, kings have fallen, queens have been installed, and Kilgallen has brought to all of these events a dash of color, a pinch of moral indignation, a soupçon of understanding, and two tablespoons of malice," as one of her readers put it recently. No wonder William Randolph Hearst, Jr. said of her, "Dorothy Kilgallen was as good a reporter as ever came down the line. She had three trademarks, a keen mind, a tailored exterior, and a steel rod as a backbone. Dorothy was life and death. She reached into the precipices of people's emotions in both her writings and her personal confrontations with her own existence." Fresh off the trial, Dorothy Kilgallen visited Los Angeles again. There, she celebrated her lofty status on February 9, 1960, just 2 years and counting from Marilyn's tragic death, with a ceremony awarding her a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. In the 6700 block of Hollywood Boulevard, the star is positioned between those of Jay Leno, famed 1950s actor Victor Mature, who appeared in more than 50 films, including The Robe, and rock star Ozzy Osbourne of the group Black Sabbath. Ironically, Marilyn's star is currently located in front of a McDonald's restaurant. At one point, a petition was circulated attempting to get the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, which oversees the stars, to change the location, It is near those of Arsenio Hall and Stephanie Powers, due to it being in a narrow area littered with spilled food and drink and crowded with threatening and aggressive panhandlers. Nothing has come of that request. Regardless, during the early 1960s, Kilgallen had shown another side of herself when she wrote in a column, "I was asked to do a painting for a charity art auction, and I finally began to work on my very first picture, The Blue Fireman, a portrait of a clown. I don't know how I happened to select the subject matter, except that I have always been touched by clowns, especially sad ones, and the whole family seems to like clowns. This painting now belongs to my younger son, Kerry, and hangs in his bedroom." The whereabouts of the painting following Kilgallen's death is unknown. Hopefully, one day it will resurface in a proper gallery for public view. On April 20, 1960, Kilgallen's painting hadn't been the subject, but everything else about her life and times had been included in an exposé in the New York Post Daily Magazine dubbed The Dorothy Kilgallen Story, a Post-Portrait, by David Gelman, with Beverly Gary, Peter J. McElroy, Sally Hammond, and Richard Montague. That it took 5 reporters to create Kilgallen's story for print was quite an achievement, as was the story being told in 10 parts. One must wonder whether any other woman in history has ever been honored with such an elongated tribute than Kilgallen, certainly at the top of her career, but now just 5-plus years from the end of that career. The opening paragraphs of the first article in the series highlight the celebrity status Kilgallen had achieved just 5 years before her death. Marilyn was a headline maker as well in 1960, and since she knew Kilgallen, she likely read at least portions of the Post series. The article began, "It was drizzling on the morning of June 12, 1957, as Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip rode up Broadway receiving a soggy welcome from the city of New York. Behind them came a procession of limousines jammed full of city officials, statesmen, and diplomats in undignified congestion. Behind these came another limousine, in the rear seat of which, in lonely splendor, sat its lone passenger, Dorothy Kilgallen. Far behind her, standing in a sort of tumbrel, their hair drizzle-soaked and scraggly, looking like an abject clutcho royalists bound for the guillotine, rode the more mortal ladies of the press, among them a somewhat disheveled Jinx Falkenberg, clinging wanly to her television credentials. As the tumbrel rattled along, one of the ladies patted the raindrops from her face with a sodden handkerchief, glared at Kilgallen's car, and snarled, 'There goes the queen covering the queen.' This poignant moment in time, an image not to be forgotten, caused the Post journalist to write, 'Wherever Dorothy Kilgallen goes, fame precedes her, envy follows her, and a crowd looks on. She is one of the communication marvels of the age.' Disturbing as the thought may seem, anyone faithfully attuned to the mass media is bound to hear her, see her, or read her sometime during the day." This statement was no exaggeration, as evidenced by the length of the articles, each one describing another world Kilgallen entered each day. Attempting to explain what this meant, the authors wrote, "When the whole awesome scheme is in operation at once, Dorothy does more communicating than a newly orbited satellite, and nearly as much traveling. During the Finch murder trial that ended a few weeks ago in California, one had the choice of reading her running story of the trial on page 1 of the Journal American, or her regular column on the inside pages, or listening to her each morning on Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick, or watching her Sunday nights on What's My Line. Thanks to the wonder of jet travel, long-distance telephone, magnetic tape, and Western Union, there was a Kilgallen for almost everyone's taste." In a direct salute to a woman for the ages, the authors noted that she frequented one of the famous Broadway night spots, the Stork Club, where a photo of Kilgallen hung directly opposite the entrance. Perhaps a quote from the owner, Sherman Billingsley, wrapped up the tribute with him being quoted as saying, "Kilgallen is just about the biggest celebrity around. She is Miss New York." Legendary show business performer Ethel Merman recalled in her book, Merman, an Autobiography, that Kilgallen was a continuing presence at the Stork Club, along with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, several Rockefellers, and, of all people, J. Edgar Hoover. Merman recalled him as quiet and not easy to get to know, and often accompanied by his chief assistant and lover, Clyde Tolson, whom she said was younger and better looking. Merman, who sang at JFK's inauguration festivities, wrote that, "I had a wonderful relationship with Kilgallen." Regarding New York City and the nightlife, the article quoted Bill Harbach, producer of The Steve Allen Show, as saying, "Dorothy has a terrific love with the island of Manhattan. She wants to kiss the pavement, the taxis. She gets excited about the first day of fall when there is a bite in the air. She loves the wonderful excitement of New York, the way the rain on the pavement makes it shiny, and the way people dress." Speaking of that subject, the Post article addressed Kilgallen's attire by stating, "Her own concern over her appearance, many feel it is unwarranted, inspires her to dress fastidiously, in just the right John Frederick's hat, Seal Chapman dress, and Delman shoes. Invariably, she cuts a presentable, attractive figure, except perhaps on television, black and white, which does no justice to her coloring. But if she can afford any feeling of insecurity on a $15,000 salary, more than $134,000 in today's currency, it derives from uncertainty about her feminine appeal." Her friend Elaine Stritch told the Post, "I think she's nuts to even worry about this sort of thing. I think she presents a pretty picture at cocktail time, prettier than she seems to realize." At one point, as a co-worker pointed out to the Post, Kilgallen never hesitated to blow a week's salary on a new hat or to spend generally three times her salary on new costumes for her conscious role as glamorous girl reporter. Additional quips in the article included, "By 1938, at the age of 25, Kilgallen was Broadway's only female columnist. By 1945, she had begun her breakfast show on the radio, and in 1949, she was taken on as the villain on What's My Line, the one who inspected the guests' hands, checked for dirt under their fingernails, played the game like a relentless prosecutor, and often came up with the right answers. What's My Line made Kilgallen famous in a curious way. An executive of the show once confided to a friend that it was the producer's psychology to have someone on the panel everyone could dislike. In a game in which the object was to determine the unusual occupation of a guest, Kilgallen was playing for keeps." Arlene Francis said, "She wants to be lighter about it, but her whole training is almost that of a prosecuting attorney. She has said to me that she should stop being so serious. Her family objected to Dorothy being on TV. They thought she didn't photograph well. Dorothy called her friend Martha Roundtree, practically in tears, and said she was quitting. Roundtree, a broadcast journalist, said she reassured Dorothy that no one photographed well in those days, and she agreed to not quit. Victims of her gossip have dubbed her with a number of less than flattering titles, such as Dorothy Spill Garbage, but she numbers among her admiring acquaintances men like Noel Coward, Truman Capote, Ernest Hemingway, and Aldous Huxley." Since Marilyn also frequented the Stork Club, her photo was prominent as well, it makes sense that she and Kilgallen may have met there from time to time. Two powerful women, so different, but so alike in many ways. Whether the fun-loving Marilyn ever dressed up for Halloween like Dorothy did in 1949 is unknown, but the bet is that Marilyn would have chuckled at this little-known photo of Dorothy in costume. Upset at what she believed were some intrusions in the articles into her personal life, Kilgallen wrote a rebuttal, including the following statement. "Newspapermen all over town are laughing over the fact that it takes five alleged reporters to set the facts wrong in the first sentence of a series running in New York's most inaccurate gazette, and every photograph that followed compounded the joke." Marilyn probably would have spoken in the same way. Regardless of her dislike for the Post articles, Kilgallen's taste for fame led to an interview a few months later in August 1960, a six-page spread in the prestigious magazine TV Radio Mirror that provided additional media exposure. Bill Cullen, popular television host of The Price is Right and I've Got a Secret, appeared on the cover. Also included were stories on Frank and Nancy Sinatra and American Bandstand's Dick Clark. A full-page color photograph accompanied the article on Kilgallen, who looked radiant in a yellow, green, and orange-striped low-cut dress. The lead article was entitled, "Her Line is Headlines, About Other Celebrities, That Is, But Dorothy Kilgallen Can't Help Being a Star Herself, Whether as TV Panelist on What's My Line or as Hostess in Her Own Fabulous Home." Large photographs featured Kilgallen relaxing on a couch in the Americana room, in front of a typewriter in her home office, and nestled closely to son Kerry, age 6, in the Victorian room. Interviewer Martin Cohen described her as wearing a champagne-colored silk sheath and coral shoes, her only jewelry a multicolored necklace. Her hair is reddish-brown, her skin delicate and translucent. In a separate photo, Kilgallen wore the ostrich feather gown she had displayed at the wedding of England's Princess Margaret. In the TV Radio Mirror article, Kilgallen discussed both her private and business life. She called television an altogether different world. "It's wonderful. Suddenly you have literally millions of friends who recognize you wherever you go and call you by your first name." Regarding What's My Line partners Bennett Cerf and Arlene Francis, Kilgallen said, "Arlene and Bennett and I are there because we're pretty good game players. It's silly to say we aren't. Otherwise, they would have cover girls to play the game, and instead of Bennett, there would be a rock and roll singer." During that interview, Kilgallen mentioned her children, stating, "I get so gabby when I talk about the children, so stop me because I know it's bragging." She then lauded Dickie's interest in music. "Right now he's immersed in 13th century choral music and progressive jazz. He's always had flawless taste in music." Of Jill, Kilgallen mentioned her prowess as an artist and noted that her daughter had the Josephine Hill part in Arsenic and Old Lace, where she gave a grand performance. 2 months before the article appeared, Kilgallen, introduced by a very young-looking Joey Bishop on the June 12, 1960 segment of What's My Line, proceeded to introduce the final panelist in a most unusual manner. She said, "My daughter is joining the publishing business tomorrow morning, and I'd like for you to meet her new boss, Mr. Bennett Cerf." Regarding young Kerry, Kilgallen described him as a husky 6-year-old with freckles across his nose who loves Dennis the Menace.